listening to KBOO. We would like to extend a great big thank you to all of our listeners that support this radio station. If you have not yet shown your support for non-commercial community radio, please do surf on over to KBOO.fm and click on Donate Today. Coming up next is Wednesday Talk Radio. We invite your calls at 503-231-8187. But first, these announcements.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Sean. Or is it the other way around?
Who cares? It's radio. Or podcast on the radio.
Is that a band?
No, that's TV on the radio. Pitch our show already.
Oh, yeah. Listen to our show.
Can you elaborate?
Listen to our show, please.
Sweet mercy, I'll do it. Our show is called Upside Down Trodden. It's informative and entertaining talk about issues important to the effort to create a more sustainable, more peaceful, and more equitable world for all life on the planet. We want to inspire you to think critically, feel deeply, and ask questions.
And we want to have a little fun along the way.
That's true.
You can find...
Can I say it?
You can find...
Can I say it?
Yeah.
Don't interrupt me again.
I won't.
You can find... Come on!
You can find us at kboo.fm/upsidedowntrodden.
Turning power inside out never sounded so good, especially on
KBOO Portland.
My landlord, a wealthy man, a living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally and march organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for a right for the common good.
Sisters have died. Over 500 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we turn back the tide. We will no longer hear your commands. We will slide your control from our lands.
Good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. My name's Paul Rowland. I'm with you every week. And of course, every other weekday morning, we have a different host on Talk Radio. Check them out if you don't already. And that was Buffy St. Marie from her release last year called Power in the Blood, Sing Our Own Song. Yes, great to hear Buffy still doing it after all these years. And we have a guest to talk about some of the things that Buffy was just singing about. And let's bring up Jacqueline Keeler right now. Good morning, Jackie. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Yeah, so that song kind of really sets a good tone for the show this morning. You know, there's I was interviewing... Well, anyway, let me just first introduce you. You live here in Portland. You grew up in Cleveland, which you've talked about in your going back to your activism on team names, sports team names, and mascots. The old fight going back decades against the Chief Wahoo and the Cleveland Indians. You've become a writer of note. Your work goes out not only in Indian country today, but also various web journals and a piece that I cited that you wrote last year in The Nation on sort of the situation that's going on now, the Clive Bundy ranch on Clive Bundy's ancestral rights. You're of Navajo Diné Yankton Dakota lineage, and we welcome you to the airwaves to talk about this kind of crazy scene going on out in eastern Oregon that I understand you've also been researching some for a piece that you're gonna come out with.
Yeah, and I'm actually planning on traveling down there to Burns as well, and yeah, I think it's so amazing to see these to see. Ignorant would be the word that, that Bundy and his followers are about the history of the United States and just how much of their worldview is informed by the mythology of Manifest Destiny.
Yeah, well, you know, I you probably didn't hear, but I talked to a local Portlander, Don Francis, who went out there and actually sat in that building and talked to Ammon Bundy, the son of Clive and Bundy, at some length, and did a report for our news last night. And this is by now, I guess, second or third hand, but he said he talked to a lawyer for them who's there, who basically said he posed the question, well, you know, you're claiming these lands for the county and the local residents. But if it was going to revert to anybody, wouldn't it revert to the native people who was taken from originally? And they said no. The lawyer said no. England no longer has any claims on the United States, and neither do the Native Americans, because to the victor belong the spoils, which is kind of almost a bed. It's almost the bedrock, belief upon which the United States base is based.
Yeah, it really does reveal that ugly, really immoral history. I mean, the mythology of the United States is what we're up against. And so that is a misreading of international law. I mean, the federal government, went through a treaty making process up until about 1871. And the issue with treaties is that it recognizes the sovereignty. We don't sign treaties. Treaties are only signed between sovereign nations. And so when Congress ratifies a treaty, they are recognizing the sovereignty of that particular nation. And certainly with the Bundy land in Nevada, the Shoshone Treaty was ratified. And it did not include any land concessions at all. So much of Nevada's land is still sort of legally in doubt, the title. And so there was no transfer. And then in Oregon, the Paiutes, the Northern Paiutes did sign a treaty, but it was not ratified because it went through Congress right around the time that they had stopped the treating process. And then later, the President Grant made a reservation about 1.78 million acre reservation, and for the Paiutes there, and included the wildlife refuge as well. And then later, they were evicted by force, and force marched actually in the middle of January in the winter. 500 tribal members, up to the Yakima Nation up in Toppenish, Washington State. So reading about that history is, you have to realize that many of our tribes have these stories of being force marched by the U.S. government in the snow. I mean, they seem to prefer to do this during the winter. I mean, right now in South Dakota, in Minnesota, there are these rides going on commemorating, these terrible atrocities that the U.S. Army did against the Dakota and Lakota people in the middle of winter. We have Wounded Knee with the Lakota, and then the mass hanging of the Dakota 38 in Mankato, Minnesota. And I reading this, it just reminds me of the same thing. I'm a citizen of the Navajo Nation. My great 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 grandmothers walked on the Long Walk from the Navajo Nation was basically a concentration camp in eastern New Mexico called Bosque Redondo. And you know, these stories are really painful to us, but our tribes have recovered. We regained our land, and we've recovered numerically. But the Paiute have not. They were about 2,000, they estimate, when the wars when the whole American incursion began on their lands in the 1800s. By the time 500 were force marched off their lands, and about 173 years ago. And today there are only 334 tribal members, and it just shows the Long Walk for Navajo people is difficult. I mean, about almost 8,000 Navajos were force marched in the middle of in a terrible situation, force marched across the state of New Mexico, and then many of them died in the concentration camp. And then we were allowed to return. The Navajo Nation we have now is the size of Ireland. It encompasses our traditional lands. And now we are a tribe of about 340,000 people. And it's, that makes it, it's difficult dealing with the Holocaust, but it's much easier when you survived it by some measure. And that's true for my father's tribe as well, the Yankton Sioux. The Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota people, I mean, they measure their population in hundreds of thousands. My husband's tribe, the same thing, the Iroquois, we're large tribes. We survived. But these small tribes that are barely hanging on, these Holocausts are even more chilling in many ways and more. I can't even imagine having to live with that history without, And as I mentioned in Democracy Now!, when they did finally get some land back, they got 10 acres back in, I think, 1923. And it was the dump at the Burns, the city of Burns, what used to be their city dump. They gave that, gave that land to the dispossessed tribal members that had returned.
How generous.
And, yeah. So it's just so emblematic of what the nature of the taking of this land, of the founding of this country that proclaims itself across the world as being this arbiter of moral behavior. It's one thing to proclaim yourself a victor through immoral means, but then to proclaim yourself also to be moral is obviously the height of hypocrisy.
So, I'm glad you brought up that Democracy Now! You were on yesterday, because any of our listeners who listen to that, there's a little bit of awkwardness. I think it's important to to say that I guess there's some sort of technical problem. You were supposed to be on a little longer. I know the music kind of went on and on. They're trying to get the connection right. That was kind of unfortunate because you were only able to get on there for fairly briefly. So I'm really glad you're able to be on here with us at greater length. And people will be able to call in at 503-231-8187 is the number to call in and talk with Jacqueline Keeler, our guest. We're talking about this messy situation, which is going on out in Burns, just outside of Burns in eastern Oregon in Harney County, where a couple dozen, seems like, people, apparently mostly from Arizona and Nevada. I know there's at least one woman from Washington State, one woman from Idaho. I'm not sure if there's any people from Oregon actually in the building. I know there's people, you know, the Don Francis yesterday reported that, you know, there are some local people who are actually, you know, in support of them, going to talk with them. That's why I'm glad you're going out there, Jackie. We've got another local Portlander out there now. Hopefully we'll have a report from him as well. It seems like, you know, almost unwittingly, they're really dredging up some really deep buried history, which maybe ultimately there are some good will come out of this, because I know now the Burns Paiute tribe, the tribe that you're talking about, that actually their reservation, they actually on Google Maps, they call it the Burns Paiute Indian Colony, which is kind of interesting. But they're going to have a press conference to respond to this situation in less than an hour, actually, which will hopefully be also bringing you some of the audio from that later on in the news. So there's so many different threads to tease out on this. We've brought up some. And another thing, I don't know if anyone listened to the other public radio station that had a report from out there, an interview, a long interview with Lavoy Finicum, I believe, who's one of the actually fairly articulate man. He was basically laying out their whole philosophy, their whole strategy, what they're trying to achieve. Really, really worth listening to. Was on, I think, their early afternoon show. I can't remember the name of it. It was on OPB. And he was talking about the idea of preemptive right, prior appropriation, first in line, creating a right, creating a property right, natural law and common law, beneficial and continuous use, all this lingo that's they sort of base their whole legal claim to what they're trying to do. Basically, that, you know, they say that the federal government has no claims to the any of these any lands basically in the United States, except for, I guess, Washington, D.C., is their view, and that so all of the land that they took, they say that only through territorial acquisition can the federal government have land, and then once they create a state, all that land has to be controlled by the state and actually more by the county, and for the beneficial use of these claimants, these settler claimants who supposedly have a preemptive right. So, you know, there's these competing interpretations of history and of law that are going on, which really, you know, it's really, I guess, I think it may be good that this is coming out, because this is really the buried legal history that Native people have been fighting against for all these years. And now maybe some other people will get a greater understanding of that.
Yeah, well, it does really go back to the founding of this country. I mean, they say they're fighting for the Constitution, and it's very interesting. One of the reasons why the colonists rebelled against King George III was because of a royal proclamation from 1763, which prohibited colonists settling west of the Appalachians and basically reaffirmed the title and security of Indian lands west of the Appalachians. And You know, my husband's tribe, as I mentioned earlier, are the Iroquois, the Six Nations, and his ancestor, Chief Joseph Brant, actually sided with the British. And one of the reasons was because the British were seen as being more, in some ways, advocates for, you know, indigenous title to the land. The reasoning, of course, was not because they had respect for indigenous people, but because they wanted to be able to have greater control over the colonists. I didn't want them to be spreading too far. But the reason a lot of the, you know, even George Washington was a land speculator, and they wanted access to those lands. They wanted particularly the Ohio River Valley, and that is one of the reasons why they actually rebelled. And so it's a desire for land, for more and more land. And I see the Bundys, you know, they are basically their ideas are informed by the notions of manifest destiny, and you know, even in the Constitution itself, after they had talked about the Indians are referred there as merciless Indian savages, and it's. They have, there's a list of like 26 different reasons why they're rebelling against King George III. And one of them is that he's setting merciless Indian savages upon them. And so there is this notion that, that from the very founding of the country, that the purpose was to gain access to Indian land and the entitlement to it. And so in some ways, you know, what they're saying is actually really very key to what this country is about, and it is a settler colonial state, and that is its purpose, is the acquisition and use of land. I would say where they're sort of falling out of line is the fact that what they want to use the land for, ranching, is extremely, you know, they receive a lot of subsidies to do it. It's not exactly a financially, you know, they make money because they receive federal subsidies. Otherwise, they would not be making money. These are very dry areas that, you know, there's not a lot of water. I think it just came out recently that Ammon Bundy himself, I think, received a bunch of, you know, subsidies from the U.S. government and federal loans. And so they
like a big loan for his trucking business or something like that.
Yes, yeah. And there's a whole drought money. They receive a lot of subsidies to make their business profitable, and it simply is not profitable. A lot of the land, the purposes, and ranching itself. I mean, my Navajo side of the family, they are ranchers near the south rim of the Grand Canyon in the Pana Desert. So I sort of am familiar with the situation. And so, you know, it's not a profitable business unless you can find that kind of federal support. And that is what they benefit from. And so they have this notion of themselves being independent, of being, you know, all these things. But they're pursuing, if you just look at it from the perspective, a business perspective, it's not a viable solution. It's not a viable way of using the land long term. It's not financially, you know, it doesn't stand on its own two feet.
Well, you know, I think the there's some really, really deep issues going on here that we're starting to get into. And, you know, one is this whole idea of a ways of life. And it's something that I think a lot of people really have a hard time looking at, because, you know, it threatens the basis of our own way of living, all of us here today in 2016, you know, when you say that those were unsustainable, it basically goes to, you know, there were certain ways of living that worked, that, you know, Native people had figured out, basically, of living within the environments that they lived in for, you know, and successfully for many thousands of years. And, you know, whether all the aspects of those ways of life any one of us might find palatable or agree with is kind of irrelevant, because, you know, they were what they were, and they persisted, and they could have continued persisting, and they still do persist in various ways, and sometimes in altered forms. But the kind of way of life that was imposed on the landscape by the settler colonialism, which then a lot of the indigenous people, some of them had to also adapt to because of colonialism, are, as you say, are not actually adapted to the landscape.
Well, yeah, and that should be addressed because their whole notion of themselves, the Bundys and their group, is that they are somehow very independent and they have the answers to an orderly society that works. These are all sort of the subtext of what they're talking about. And I think that the big differences between societies, in indigenous societies in North America and societies in Europe and in Asia, and, is that there was a level of equality. And the level of inequality required to run some of these old systems is greater than what is acceptable today to most Americans, I think. I mean, you look at ranching in the past in the West, and cowboys were they were abused. You know, many of them were very young. This was not a great job back in the day, and they did not have long lifespans. They didn't live much past into their 20s.
So are you calling into question the myth of the cowboy?
This was basically a form of child slave labor. I mean, and, you know, this is, and of course, I'm sure some, you know, cattle barons made money, but to a large extent, it was a bit like the factory system in that it relied on young people who had no other options in life, who could be worked to death, you know. And you know, I think that it's often been remarked upon that a lot of the frustration of Bundy and folks like him is this idea that they've been disenfranchised from the American, the dream, the promises that were made to them. And part of it is they need opportunities. I think that this war on the wildlife refuge and the notion that the land, you know, I grew up here actually in the Pacific Northwest. My family left Cleveland when I was a preschooler. So I remember the whole getting into arguments as a young person about the spotted owl issue, and I actually told a woman, I was a kid, but I was, this woman was going on and on about it, and she was from some, community that was affected by it, that they're in the timber business, and I was like, the spotted owl has evolved over millions of years, it can't find another habitat. You're a human being, I mean, you can go get educated, you can get a job, you know, elsewhere. I mean, you're not tied to the land to that extent. And this notion that these communities must be sustained, even if they are not, and if the U.S. is actually founded on this idea of profitability, I mean, their whole argument for their way of life doesn't hold up if it's not actually profitable. and the issue is that, you know, I think Bundy has been talking about how the county, Harney County, was very, you know, had a great standard of living in the 1980s until all these, you know, these draconian laws and land use issues. But the issue is that, you know, the sort of very extreme extractive industries like timber and such and ranching have a limited lifespan in a landscape like that. And they require, you know, a certain amount of oversight to exist. I think that's something that they can't get their minds around. And because of the lack of social mobility in this country and support on every level for Americans to change their social situation, they see no other options in life besides what they've always done.
I'd just like to encourage people to call in. I assume people are just attentively listening here, but if you would like to ask a question of Jacqueline Keeler or make a comment, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Sorry, go ahead, finish your thought.
I think that, you know, what America, I think needs to do is to question the fundamental mythology upon which it was founded, and it is a mythology that has been the vehicle for so many sins. I mean, I think, you know, looking at the issue of slavery, you know, and of genocide, and it's an extremely immoral history that is not honestly dealt with. And certainly people like the Bundys and their understanding of the world reflects this ignorance. And it's something that we need to address. And this has actually been a great opportunity for the Burns Paiute tribe to address its own treatment. And I hope it actually works in their favor.
You know, you're speaking of profitability. You know, I don't know much about it. I didn't copy this article. I just saw it this morning, but it was something about gold in Harney County. So, you know, there could be a backstory to what's going on that may come out. You know, I don't want to read too much into it, you know, but, you know, the element that a lot of the people, you know, I'm sure there's a mix of people out there. I'm sure there's people who are, you know, very, really sincere about what they're doing. They're kind of caught up in these things because of feelings of, you know, their own feeling of marginalization, justified or not, their own feeling of, you know, being sort of trampled upon by whatever the big forces in the world that maybe they sort of focus on big government as sort of symbolizing that. You know, some of them might have some sort of understanding also of, you know, big corporate interests as well. And then some of them might be more cynically motivated, perhaps. I don't know. There could even be some influence by larger moneyed forces. You know, I don't know any of this, but I do know that, you know, some of them come out of that whole, you know, wise use movement, the Sagebrush Rebellion. These are, you know, like James Watt, the Interior Secretary for Ronald Reagan, was sort of emerged out of that. The whole kind of take back the West for private property interests. But, you know, the little guys, you know, look at it as being, you know, their own property interests. But what you really have is much larger, also corporate interests, corporate ranching, corporate mining, corporate logging. So a lot of times these, you know, the small fry, as it were, kind of get utilized by, and I don't know any of that. I don't know if there's any, you know, I don't know what their ties are. You know, hopefully there'll be some more research coming out about any of that. But so, I don't know, that's something to flag. Maybe there is something more in Harney County. I did read an article about gold out there. And so, and they have talked about opening up, you know, not just the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and other places to logging, cattle grazing and mining. So anyway, that's mm-hmm. just something to flag.
Well, that, you know, that there are these conflicting interests. I mean, the notion, though, that, well, it's very interesting because, one, the notion that corporate interests have not always been, had a huge place at the table is wrong. I mean, you know, I am certainly mining and interests, you know, that goes back to definitely to the Old West. I mean, but the issue has always been that, there's always been, I think, you know, it the homesteading of Indian lands by white settlers, and this notion that they could have land if they worked hard, is probably a part of this. It is also a mythology. I mean, most people who pursued homesteads did not actually end up after the 5 years getting free title. It was a very difficult way, and I think it was always somewhat of a, you know, very, I mean, look at what happened during the 1930s, during the Dust Bowl years, and there really were a series of economic catastrophes for farmers every decade from the 1800s on. And so this notion that there was always a sort of settled class of landowners in America, small landowners, is in itself a mythology. And and there's always been a much larger place at the table for corporate interests in America. I mean, look at the Teapot Dome. I mean, it goes all the way back. There's never been a time where the small guy has had, the small fry. I mean, the whole purpose of the West was as an outlet for the frustration of the underclass in the East, on the East Coast. And so it's, yeah, I'd say that's a mythology. And certainly the Bundy family is filled with mythology, even about their own history. In the Nation article I wrote, definitely their story about being there since the 1870s was easily debunked by looking at the records. So, I mean, they were actually there after the founding of the BLM and in the 1930s. You know, their whole story is just one, it's just a fantasy, you know? So I think what is clashing for white males, I think, is this notion, the sort of a notion that they will have a certain standard of life, and other groups will have to sacrifice for that, like Indians, like the Paiute tribe and the Shoshone,
and the land itself.
And that as long as they can get these constant concessions, I mean, you know, the reason why President Grant, decided to start home, allowing settlers to go onto the Paiute reservation there at Malheur, was because of white people, white settlers, the little guys saying, "We want this, we want this, we want this." And so they're used to kind of getting those kind of concessions from the federal government, but they are stopgap concessions in the end. I mean, a lot of those ranchers failed. You know, I mean, just getting access to these things and implementing these sort of outdated economic models is not a long-term solution to their problems. You know,
and they're just trapped. Anyway, they're just, you know, in a sense, I mean, there's these various ways of looking at it. I mean, they're also kind of just trapped in these huge forces that they just don't understand. And so it's easy for them to fall into these simplistic, you know, mythological ways of looking at it. But they're dangerous mythologies, because who knows what could end up happening there. You know, it seems like, you know, it could get ugly out there, and similar situations have gotten ugly when people feel like their back is against the wall, or they put their back against the wall. Anyway, I just want to interrupt you and say we've got a couple callers. So let's go to our first caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I listened to the entirety of that interview with the gentleman from Arizona on the corporate public radio station yesterday at noon, and I found it interesting, a couple things. I found it interesting that he has this idea, this fantasy in his head that he's going up against the federal government of the United States of America, and he's just like, the way he spoke was like that didn't even exist in his mind. Because he kept saying over and over, it's all about the state and Harney County and the state of Oregon and Burns, Oregon. And I find it interesting that this gentleman, and I guess, I mean, he's supposedly speaking for the group. I don't know. Maybe he's certainly speaking for himself. You know, was thinking that the federal government's going to have, you know, it's sort of like they don't exist anymore. They sort of like wipe that part of his mind away, that there's any federal government involvement whatsoever. And they were just going to come in and take over and do this. And he wasn't going to leave until all the ranching and the mining was back, and all the people could come out and go hunting, and the people could, you know, dig for gold, whatever they're going to do. And it was just going to be all good. I mean, it was mind-blowing that he had this vision in his head of that's the way reality was going to present itself. And as soon as everything got back to normal, is the way he wanted it in his mind, the way he was to say, you know, during the interview, what he was saying, that then they'll go home and he'll go back to his grandchildren, back to his life in Arizona. I mean, it was almost laughable.
Yeah, the cavalry comes to save the day or something. They see themselves as these sort of like, yeah, it's almost like they're fleeing from the reality where they are to sort of you know, take on this sort of mythological battle or something is very strange.
Well, there's this notion that they know best, you know,
right?
And that if they could just be in charge again completely, then everything will be okay, without a real analysis of whether or not the economic policies they're proposing have any viability.
Well, I think that's interesting if you're sitting around at a bar, you know, talking hypothesis. But we know that, I mean, these people, I mean, they show up there out in the middle of, you know, the woods out there, and they're, you know, leaving their life from whatever they were doing. And I think cattle, if he's a cattleman in Arizona, need help in the winter. Maybe it snows there where he is. I have no idea. But, I mean, you know, I know ranching, farming, all this stuff is big work, and people need to be there and on the job and doing things. And anyway, I just found it mind-blowing that he was just saying things the way he was saying them. And also, you know, he was supposedly quoting, paraphrasing, whatever, Thomas Jefferson, whomever. And it was sort of like history began that there were never any red people there. There were never any Indians there ever.
Yeah, well, that
was like, you know, not one word of that. And, of course, the NPR reporter guy, he never mentioned that either.
Yeah, he does. Well, you know, the issue goes, I mean, the issue of sovereignty is at the heart of this. I mean, and their notion that, you know, their states, all 50 states do not have sovereignty that predates the founding of this country. Only the 13 original colonies ever had sovereignty that they exercised before the creation of the federal government. There is no legal standing for the state of Oregon to have sovereignty that predates or in any way is over that of the federal government. And actually, the states themselves occupy a position, legally speaking, under international law, that is lower than that of tribes. Tribes have a higher status than states do, because of their status as sovereign nations. You know, when you're looking at it from a particularly legal point of view, there much of the land in the United States, there is no, the U.S. government holds by force, not by any sort of legal argument that could really. I mean, the main legal argument the U.S. government that is under constitutional law is the argument of the doctrine of discovery, and that is actually comes out of one of the first Supreme Court cases regarding the issue of title to the land, and that is basically the first Supreme Court Chief Justice Marshall had to kind of create the law of this country, and so he looked through a lot of different legal sources, and he went back to a papal bull from I think it was 1454, written by Pope Nicholas V, and in that they declare what is now called the Doctrine of Discovery, that only discovering Christian nations have fee simple title to the land they discover. So the minute a European Christian nation recognized by the Pope landed on our shores, the title of the land immediately reverted to that nation. And this is why when these European explorers came, they put the flag down. They did all these things to sort of affirm legally under papal law their right to this land. And this constitutes a human rights violation. And this has been recognized by the United Nations, that basically indigenous people of the Americas are one of the only peoples in the world that do not have their fee simple title to the land is not recognized. And this is part of U.S. constitutional law. And it is the flimsiest thing. I mean, they only hold it because they can. And this is, legally speaking, the tribes have a much stronger predate. The Paiutes are recognized sovereign entity that have sovereignty that predates the creation of the state of Oregon and the Shoshone in Nevada with the Bundy land. The states of Nevada and Oregon have no standing to claim any kind of sovereignty. So his whole argument is just
sounds like the kind of an original mythology is what you're saying.
Well, they're basing their whole thing back to the fact that the 13 colonies, but the rest of the states that were created afterwards do not have that status.
Well, listen, we've got another caller. And we've only got 15 minutes left, so let's August, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think it's really interesting in the last little bit you touched on it with the papal law and the domain of Christian nations. It really ties into the entitlement and mythology you were talking earlier, that I feel like it comes out of this history of Christianity being able, like Christian people being able to just take and use the land, any natural resources. It's up to them because of how God in the Bible gave it to them. And I think it's really a sense of entitlement that has continued down from the mercantile and the imperial era, where the Spanish, you know, enslaved Native people along the western United States, and similar things are happening all across the Americas.
Jackie?
Yes, yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that, you know, the sovereign status of tribes is deeply misunderstood in this country, and it's willful. It's been U.S. policy to cloud the actual political reality of tribes as sovereign states that are basically have their sovereignty suppressed by the U.S. by U.S. power. And so there are these conflicting mythologies. One, that the U.S. is the national sort of I guess going even further back, city on the hill, showing a democratic and civil society to the rest of the world. And on the other hand, its founding is deeply based in sort of as these guys, Bundy and his friends, are saying is, that we took the land, we won it, and we have a right to it. Those are two very conflicting ideas. The tribes do occupy a status higher than states under international law. The treatying process, the fact that, my tribes particularly have treaties with the United States means that they're recognized by Congress as sovereign states, national states, and that under international law treaties, you cannot treaty away your existence. So our nations still exist, and that is something that by giving us citizenship, on the maps you'll see that tribes are listed kind of in the same sort of faint outline that parks are. This is all a way of clouding that political reality.
So, August, are you still there? Did you have any other comments?
No, that was great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling in. And I think we have another caller. Jeremy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. The Times today, I'm just sort of scanning the article, but the headline is "Armed Protesters in Oregon Seek to Undo Policy to Shape the West." Is that accurate? I mean, the idea being that they then quote all these, sort of...
Are you on a speakerphone? You're kind of...
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
There you go.
Sorry.
Could you repeat that?
My diaphone is trying to kill me. They then quote all these, land management experts at Western colleges saying that the government is a harsh but reasonable landlord, and that if what these bozos ask for, if they were to get it, which they're not, but is to have the BLM go away and turn it over to the states, then they would just be angry at the states.
So the
entire thing is sort of like,
yeah,
shrouded in fake demands for a hopeless situation.
I think the idea is that the whole states, states' rights movement has always been about, getting a different policy in place, a policy that they agree with, and whether it's slavery or what have you, and this is sort of the same thing. The expectation is, and I think that the Bundys would be a little disappointed with the state of Oregon. It's, the legislature is extremely progressive. They would not get the kind of, it's not the kind of thing that they think is going to happen. And
they would go back to the county.
Yeah, well, the county, I think it's been noted many times, the county is one of the largest in the country. It's larger than many states, like the state of New Jersey. But it has a population of 7,000 people. And so you're giving these 7,000 people who live in this county, sort of rights that other American citizens don't possess, you know. And it's, I mean, I think that it's a very strange problem. It's a way of sort of eliminating other competing ideologies and thoughts by making the pool smaller and smaller until it's the pool they want, I mean, in charge. And that's all that argument is about. And but, you know, it really doesn't hold up under any sort of analysis, legally, economically. The state of Oregon would probably impose even stricter regulations than the federal government does. I mean, it's a very democratic legislature. I mean, part of Eastern Oregon is, you know, of course, very Republican, but it's a very low density population. They don't have the votes to carry the kind of open season that they want to have on the land.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Jeremy.
Question I had.
Okay, go ahead.
I had another question. I missed the beginning, so you may have covered it. I apologize if that's the case. But how significant is the sort of Mormon background of the Bundy family? Is that you know,
yeah,
the same sort of things that I associate with you know, scary mystical Christianity? Is that a subtext here? Because it's not in the Times article.
Yeah, I think it is. Obviously, the Bundys have referenced it. I think there was one article where they talked about how one of the guys there at the wildlife refuge calls himself after the angel Moroni, who is a Mormon angel. Ammon himself is named after a Mormon. It's very interesting because there is this crossover, the mythology of Mormonism. There's this idea that because, you know, my mom's Navajo, in the 1970s, the Mormon Church began to really recruit Native Americans to be members of their church, with the idea that Native Americans were the lost tribe of Israel that was mentioned in the Book of Mormon. And so the Book of Mormon, I understand, is supposed to recount like some of Native history. and it's a sort of mythological, sort of Middle Eastern ancient civilization sort of stuff. I think it was noted that even that part of Eastern Oregon is part of this. The Mormons had actually wanted to create a provisional state in the U.S. In 1849, they wanted the federal government to recognize their authority over a large swath of the United States, and that included that part of Eastern Oregon, Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon, yeah. And even went down to San Diego, and they wanted all this sort of dry land that they thought no one else would want, and they wanted the U.S. government to give them jurisdiction over it, and they called it the State of Deseret. And so so there is a real kind of Mormon connection, and the Mormon mythology is sort of different than the rest of Christian theology. And I think there's some indication that that the Book of Mormon is actually sort of has its basis in early sort of science fiction fantasy novel writing of that time period. It's very interesting. It's another, and I think that many people, Mormonism has a really very large base in the West, you know, because of their policy of large families, of collective sort of community. I think that you would find that many states, like the state of Idaho and everything kind of adjacent to Utah, there is a large Mormon influence politically and economically.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Jeremy. I'd just like to say that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 in just a few minutes on Political Perspectives, Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, speaks on our renewable future with an analysis of the fossil fuel supply and climate risk. We want to thank all of our KBOO members. And if you are not a member, you can always become one very simply by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, who's giving an Indigenous perspective on the incident at Malheur, this takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge headquarter building just outside of Burns, Oregon, out in eastern Oregon. We've been covering this fairly heavily on KBOO. This is a chance to get a real different perspective. As I mentioned at the outset, she wrote an article last year on Cliven Bundy's, quote, ancestral rights. If the Nevada rancher is forced to pay taxes or grazing fees, he should pay them to the Shoshone. That was written in April of last year. She's working on a new piece that is based on this current incident, which is, of course, linked to that previous one, because there's two or three sons of Cliven Bundy's who are kind of leading this renegade charge out there to reclaim the usurped federal territory for the apparently what they think are the rightful claimants to that land. And that's competes with what the historical analysis that Jackie's putting out here in terms of the actual native history and the mythology, the settler mythology, going all the way back to the Doctrine of Discovery. Anyway, it's a lot to take in. I don't know, Jackie, are there sources? I mean, people really, we should be doing our homework here, all of us. We should be looking this up. I'll ask you to hold off on your answer to that question, because I do want to squeeze in our last caller here. But think of some sources that people could go to. So, Ryan, go ahead. You're on the air now.
Hi. Yeah, really great that she's on today. I really appreciate this. I, too, listened to the interview on the other public station last night. I really appreciated it. I appreciated that the representative from the Bundy group was actually pretty well spoken and brought up a lot of things that I want to investigate and open my mind, but the you know, to what they are thinking. And I think the main thing is that giving them these opportunities to speak and letting them, you know, giving them a way to speak and not feel threatened and speak their mind is really advantageous for everyone, because I think that they might be an exaggerated version, but I think the support that you see for some of the presidential nominees shows that there's kind of this mindset out there, and for us to have these discussions and be able to talk about them right at their root, I think, is really important. But of course, in that interview yesterday, the thing that was so glaring at the end was that he's talking about the claims to the land and not one mention of the Native Americans. It was just like so glaring. And of course, it made me think, boy, wouldn't it be interesting if after this whole thing settles down, a bunch of Native Americans went and took their chance to take over. What would the response be then? Of course, I wouldn't want to be in there when that happens. But, you know, that just made me think, boy, what would happen if it was a group of, we've actually in the 70s, we've seen what happens when they do that. So that was my comment.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. There has been a lot of comparison to what happened at Wounded Knee in the early 1970s. You know, I think when Native people get guns and take over a federal building, and I think the federal building in question, Wounded Knee, was the U.S. Post Office there. And yeah, that was, immediately the FBI came down with guns and people died, you know. It's, I actually want to go down to Burns to speak to Eamon Bundy in person and maybe have a conversation. I think it is important to have these conversations. I don't know, after the experience of the Bush administration, how much you can change minds. But it is good to get out of the realm of speaking in a loop in which people just begin to feel more and more frustrated and alienated. I am curious to see, is it possible to have a conversation about these issues? And if you would tell people things they don't know, you know, like about the idea, Indigenous rights to land, would it inform their position? Would it alter it? I hope it would, you know. And we need to, I end my article in The Nation by describing the ways in which my dad's family are working with ranchers in Nebraska and South Dakota. They actually formed the Cowboy and Indians Alliance to fight the Keystone XL pipeline. And my dad's cousin, she laid the groundwork for that. and going, you know, I attended some of the meetings on my dad's reservation between the ranchers and farmers, the white ranchers and farmers and the tribes. And it was really inspiring. I mean, the summer I also got to go to Pierre, South Dakota, and attend the South Dakota Public Utility Commission meetings regarding the Keystone XL permitting process. And I covered those for Indian Country Today. And I got to, you know, my whole dad, it was like a family reunion there, and we tackled that issue. And it was really encouraging to see the solidarity between the ranchers, the farmers, the white ranchers and farmers, and the Indian and the tribes. And so my point is that the land can bring us together. It doesn't have to divide us. The land can help us make relatives of each other, and maybe will be a real fulfillment of some of the American mythology.
All right. That's a great note to end on. As usual, never enough time, Jackie. So thank you so much for joining us, Jacqueline Keeler, Yankton, Dakota Navajo writer, activist here in Portland, for sharing your thoughts today. And stay tuned for more great programming, Political Perspectives, coming up. Richard Heinberg, this is Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, as always, Paul Rowland.
To America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid. With each passing year, the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. become more and more necessary to remember. With this in mind, the World Arts Foundation and Kate Booth Foundation members would like to invite you, your family, and friends to their 31st anniversary and tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 18th, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Highland Christian Center in Portland. As in years past, there will be a variety of local and regional choirs, performers, and entertainers, all paying homage to the work and legacy of Dr. King in our efforts to keep his dream alive. So remember, Monday, January the